Today it's my distinct pleasure to talk to, I believe, the oldest surviving radio veteran in British Columbia, Mr. Wilf Ray, who actually started in broadcasting 2 years before I was born. I believe it was 1944.
That's right, Mike.
How did you first get into the business at the age of 18? What piqued your interest in becoming a broadcaster?
Well, I, on reflection, could have gone two routes. My family were always admirers of judges and people that could speak well. And I figured, well, if I go into Canadian radio, I may have an immediate esteem in the family, the fact that their only son is on radio. The other maybe a bit of motivation goes back to around about 1941, 42. We were poor as church mouses, Mike, and I remember a program called Treasure Trails on CKWX at 543 Seymour Street in Vancouver. And you'd go in, and if you're lucky enough to have your name drawn, then they would ask you a question. The top prize was $5. It was $1, $2. Laurie Irving was the MC, I remember. Cal George was there, Ken Hughes, Fred Bass, all the great pioneers at CKWX. And over in CJOR, of course, we had Ross Mortimer, Dorwin Baird. Uncle Billy Hassel was, roaming at several of the stations. But I was in the audience, and they called my name, and they were going to give away the top dollar of $5. And I went up, and Laurie Irving asked me the question, why did the bear go over the mountain? Now, keep this in mind. This is about 60 years ago, mm-hmm. and I still festers inside of me the fact that I came up with the answer, why did the bear go over the mountain? And I'm thinking, and there's a time limit, of course. And I said, to see another bear. And so I lost out. And I tell you, that $5, if I had it in those days, is like a couple of $100 today. Mm-hmm. Anyway, whether that stuck in my craw or not, I don't know. But I started as a morning disc jockey on CKMO, 1410 on the dial. And in those days, Mike, Canadian radio, there was no television, so a morning program is where your audience was. I was doing that, for about maybe a little over a year. I was at it was the Sprotshaw School of Business at the corner of Howe and Robson Street. Bruce Arundel was the owner, along with Anna Sprott, and she had her adopted daughter running the station, Kay Willis, who there was a drinking problem there. To go back to 1944, 45, 46, I could be jumping all over the place. But I remember at CKMO, they had a Christmas party. It was at the Hotel Georgia. I was never drunk in my life, but I was drinking fruit juices and that. So they started this party in the Hotel Georgia for the staff. And I ended up consuming maybe about half a dozen glasses of fruit juice. Everybody else was imbibing and liquor. They got around to toasting the different people that had done well at the radio station. I looked for my glass to toast, and all the fruit was gone. So I turned to my buddy. I says, you got something I could use as a liquid? So he takes out a 26 under the table. I don't know who it was. Pours me a straight big glass of rye. And we started toasting this person, that person. So I ended up drinking a whole glass of rye. Never had any liquor in my life. They tell me about 20 minutes later, I don't remember anything. They tell me that I was dancing with as the chicks. I went down to the furnace room of the Hotel Georgia, started to sweep it out. I just about got killed crossing Howe and Georgia. Ended up in the radio station. In those days, I used to pack money. And I'm sitting passed out. I don't even remember somebody coming in asking to borrow some money from me, because when I woke up, my wallet was in my hand still. Anyway, I really had a hangover to the degree that next day, Leo Nicholson, who was doing a play-by-play broadcast of the hockey games then, turned around, and I was in the control room as an operator looking after his program. And unfortunately, I can still remember, right in the middle of the hockey play-by-play by Leo, I threw the wrong switch, and out comes this In the Mood by Glenn Miller, because, you know, I didn't want to continually hear the play-by-play, so I was entertaining myself on the side by listening to some great Glenn Miller music. So anyway, that's some of the early memories. I can still remember at Sprott Shaw, we owned the second floor, and Bill Pike is now gone. He was the station announcer. I had a program called Compare the Hits. Mm-hmm. And I was, in those days, you know, we had the luxury of having an operator, and you were in the announcing booth, or vice versa. I'm sitting in the announce booth, and all of a sudden comes on a selection. It was Woody Woodpecker was supposed to be singing it, and he's going, and so Bill Pike, who did the commercials in between the introductions of the Compare the Hits music, started to chuckle, and of course the record ended, and he was still laughing, and he starts doing this commercial, and in the meantime, I walk out laughing out on the roof of the Sprott Shaw building, and the liquor store used to be on the other side of the alley there. Old timers will remember the location, Robson Howe or Robson and Hornby. I just about fell off the roof laughing at Bill Pike trying to do a commercial and laughing in between the sentences, to the degree that Kay Willis, the manager, having me listening, phones up and really gave him a blast, you know. He just about got fired over it. But in those days, no, radio was very entertaining, great fellowship with your buddies. And you know the old story. I don't know if any people that you've interviewed will recall this, but in the old days, if you're doing the news, you wouldn't just turn around and take out each story. You'd rip off maybe about 3 feet of teletype, and it was quite common if somebody rushed into the last minute to do the news, which was Canadian Press, had all the different stories there. You start reading, somebody would set fire to the top of the paper, and you're reading as fast as you can. Otherwise, you know, you're going to end up burning yourself. But we had a lot of kibitzing, but I enjoyed there. Hal Rod was another announcer, I remember. Erica Agello. Bob Fortune was at 1410. You know, a lot of the great personalities have gone now. But in 46, I left to go to CKWX. And Jack Cullum came on doing the program. And Jack, I think it was called Pacific Patrol. And then he started becoming quite listened to.
Speaking about you and Jack Cullum, which I think you both ended up working opposite each other on different stations.
That is correct. Jack in 47 went over to CKW, and I was back on CKMO doing my DX Prowl. Jack had, and then when he went to NW, called his program the Owl Prowl. But Jack was notorious for doing way out stuff, you know. I was pretty well straight, middle of the road type. And Vic Waters, there was the three of us in competition, and we were on like in the evening, 10:30 until 1 o'clock. Jack had the way out music, and plus his, all these gags and kibitzes he used to do. What a fantastic memory. I mean, Jack, 50 years in Canadian radio, and his recall of especially the movie industry was unprecedented. I couldn't believe somebody could, even up until he passed away. He had a great recall. I'm jumping ahead here. I was going to say that a lot of the music Jack had was Armed Forces stuff that I had got from a guy called Stan Gordon. When I left in 1950, I'll jump ahead for a moment, I gave all my music to Jack. I went into the being in the photography business for about 3 years, and eventually in 1954, I went to work at Bo McLean. We'll get into that in a moment. Anyway, getting back to Jack, he was on NW. And Vic Waters was playing jazz. And Jack and him were in competition with me. I was doing middle of the road music. And one day, Bill Ray phones me up. I can still remember being in the newsroom at CKMO. And he said, "Wilf, I'm interested in having you come over to be our all night record man." And he says, what does the station pay you? I says, well, Bill, I started at $50 a month in 1944. I'm now getting $75 a month. This was about 1947. And he said, well, I'll double that salary if you come over and be the all-night record man. And I foolishly accepted the offer. That got rid of the competition for Jack. And I went over there, and I lasted nearly a year. I couldn't stand working while everybody else was asleep. And when I was asleep in the daytime, all the action was taking place. But anyway, Jerry Davies took over from me, and he lasted 20 years as the all-night man on SNW. One little bit of a side, I didn't realize it at the time, but I had an opportunity to sue CKNW, and here's the basis. I didn't work at the station on Columbia Street. I was the all-night record man. I was in Queensboro at the transmitter. And in those days, you know, in the transmitter, they had these Dr. Cyclops, big tubes and radiation taking place. Well, I got married in 1954, and we tried for years to have a child. There was no way. My wife had been married before, and she had had a girl, so I knew it wasn't her fault. And I didn't twig on the fact, wait a minute, maybe I'm sterile. And sure enough, in the 60s, I finally got the message. Wait a minute. I'm there all night for nearly a year, 10 hours a day. That radiation that was coming out of the transmitter, I must have, you know, must have hit me. Fortunately, it wore off, and we had our first child in 1963.
You've had a very interesting and varied career. You've done a lot of things, done some great promotions.
Yeah, really, when you talk about that, Mike, I've been involved in six vocations, being in broadcasting all my life, and I still am, because although my program ended in October the 26th, 2008, because 600 on the AM dial, the old CJOR signal, the station management wanted to get the new FM license, 100.5, the peak, mm-hmm. on FM, and they were prepared in their submission to the CRTC to give up the station. So Dal Richards and myself, we were on Sunday nights. It ended, and fortunately, about 8 months later, I didn't think I could handle it financially, but I've got 25 years of rebroadcasts. I'd go in there every Sunday evening. I did the program live. I was never taped, except I think on one occasion when I got my heart attack, the first heart attack, when I was working for Jimmy Patterson. But I'm jumping all around here in the time frame, and it may be hard for somebody to follow what I'm trying to say. But anyway, to get back to 1950, I left CKNW, and I was telling you about the different six vocations. Radio, I've been a professional photographer. Then I went into being the advertising manager for Jimmy Patterson when he was the general manager at Bull McLean. We built a big BOMAC neon sign, mm-hmm. which is now a Toys R Us on Broadway. There's enough cement in the base of that sign to pave 60 driveways in the average home, over 10 miles of wiring. In 1959, I was the advertising manager. In those days, Mike, it's not like today when you sell cars. There'd be 40 or 50 people come on the lot. And the realtors, the salesman would say to the customers, we got a stock here, but the business is booming. And all of a sudden on the PA, this is me on the PA, it's another one sold, ladies and gentlemen. Want to congratulate Mr. and Mrs. Morgan on a 1954 Pontiac. And the salesman would say, see, they're going fast. You better make up your mind. We set a North American record of selling 1,036 cars in May of 1959. From the advertising manager, Jimmy sent me back to work for General Motors from 61. They wanted somebody with fire line experience, so I went back and worked for the agency there. And Jimmy and Ralph Cunningham, the old Cunningham drugstore is here in Vancouver, which is now Shoppers. They made an application along with 20 other people to get, Pat Burns had been on 600 on the AM dial with probably the first talk show in Canadian radio. And he was fiery and he was full of vigor and vitality. And the in the old days was the BBG. Mm-hmm. But the CRTC turned around and told Mrs. Chandler she'd have to sell the station. So there was 20 applicants. I remember going to the BBG hearing in Ottawa. Ralph and Jimmy got the station with the understanding, part of the programming, I was to be on Sunday evenings, 6 to midnight, as director of religious broadcast for 600. So anyway, that's now 1961. The actual, that's when I went back to Toronto. The actual application was about 1965 that was made for 600. Jimmy, had turned around and was actually doing his advertising from Toronto when he started out on his own at 18th and Canby for Jack Marshall, what Motors used to be. He took it over, subsequently built a new building on Main Street in 1964. I came back to help him with his official introduction. And then in 1965, he wanted me to come back to help him build his two empires. He'd already had the dealership, but he got the radio station with Ralph Cunningham. So I came back under that premise that as long as he owned the radio station and my health was good, I'd always have my own radio program. So it really was sad for me to turn around in 2008 and end up with no, you know, I had said to Dell on one of his shows, Dell, and Dell is now 92 years young. Mm-hmm. I said, and I am 10 years his junior. So I said, Dell, be nice when we're both 100 years of age to be on together, you know, because he'd come on before me and I came on after at 10 o'clock. Sunday nights, I did 6 to midnight as originally, 8 to 11, 9 to 11. Then when they got JR Country in 1986, I moved from 600 over to JR. JR in 1986, I turned around, and in 1994, they wanted to take the regular music on 600 and go with the what they called the bridge, which was going to be gospel music, real hot, fast, rockish type of gospel. And they asked me, they virtually begged me to leave the JR Sunday evening, I was on 9 to 11, and come on the bridge. And I reluctantly did so. I'm a team guy, so I went along. Well, I lost all my listeners, Mike, because most people listening to me, you know, they couldn't tolerate that hard gospel. Yeah. You couldn't even hear the words being sung because of how loud the background music is or was. So anyway, and then about nearly 2000, oh, I guess close to 2000, they gave up the bridge because it wasn't economically feasible. They weren't building their audience, and they allowed me to go back to my old programming and leave me alone. But they were actually dictating what I should play when the bridge was going there. Mm-hmm. At its start. They wanted to pick out the music, whereas I always have been a free spirit all my life. My whole format on my program was contemporary, traditional, and country, inspirational, and good news music.
And you mixed it beautifully.
And then I would bridge it. I didn't do this right at the start, but the last decade, I'd have hit parade standards as bridge music in between, because I was catering to the person that never had darkened the door of a church, but would relate to the music. Mm-hmm. And I never ever started my program in the latter years by coming on. When I first started in 1965, when Jimmy got the station, and I would turn around, I scripted the whole program for nearly a year. And I got to the point where it seemed superficial. It didn't seem to flow. So I turned around and decided I'm just gonna ad lib. And it's amazing, many times when I've gone to throw the microphone on, I've said things that were quite eloquent, and I'm saying to myself, man, this must be a gift from God, because I don't have that intelligence to quote those words. And the big word, extemporaneous broadcasting.
Yes.
I'm pleased to hear you're interviewing as many of the old radio personalities that you can get your hands on. But to me, radio has always been my first love. And I did that program 43 years from 1965 until it ended in 2008 for nothing. I never got a dime for doing the program. It was a work of love, and I was working for Jimmy Pattison, of course, and I was his advertising manager from 65 to 67 when he had me come back to help him build his two empires, the car dealership and the radio station. Then in 1967, I mean, I could spend hours telling you, I'm the guy that wrote every press release when we went into the world of public companies. 1967, through my connections with Dow Jones, Canadian Press, the Financial Post, the Financial Times, Broadcast News, the Vancouver Sun, the Vancouver Province. In those days, unless you came out of Bay Street, who's this young upstart coming over and trying to get into the world of entrepreneurship? Who's this Jim Pattison? So I got paid, Mike, in the early days, as much inches as I could get for Jimmy to get started. And when I did have interviews and set up appointments for him to talk to the media, they would always ask me ahead of time, well, what's this Pattison guy like? And I was able, and it's still as true today as it was 43 years ago. The way to describe Jimmy, I said, is this one sentence. When your work becomes your recreation as well as your occupation, then you found the real niche in life. I said, that's him. I said, the guy doesn't go and play golf. He's more interested in acquiring companies. I mean, we liquidated over 20, 30 companies. We absorbed them. He's always had a great love for radio and broadcasting. And all I wanted to say is that I was the director of corporate communication until I got my first heart attack working for him in 1980. But I wrote every press release from day one. And there's several instances, especially one, I won't go into detail, but I don't say this boastfully, but if it wasn't for me, he might have gone under. They called his note, it's in his book, You Gotta Wanna. I'm the only employee, picture-wise, that is in his book that he put out in 1986, entitled You Gotta Wanna, the same time he was in charge of Expo 86. And all of the different areas there, it was, you talk about radio being exciting and that, but it was exciting being in the world of conglomerates and wheeling and dealing all over North America. Jimmy got his note called by the Canadian Bank of Commerce. In those days, if you only had a bank account with one bank and they called your note and you tried to go to another Canadian bank, they treated you like leprosy. He couldn't, very briefly, he didn't know or didn't care or didn't realize, but the director of Canadian Bank Commerce was also the director of Maple Leaf Mills, and that's the company he was trying to acquire. And so the director said, I'll fix this guy. So they called his note, and we're talking, you know, several million dollars there. So he was able, at the very end, after trying to get money out of Canada, he was able to borrow the money from the Marine Midland Bank in New York. And the CEO lent him the money on the strength of Neonex International in those days, before he went private and changed it to the Jim Pattison Group. But on the strength of the film that I did, he was able to get the loan, and subsequently thereafter, he didn't want to make the same mistake. So he would take several companies, put them with the TD, some of the Bank of Montreal, and others, so that he wouldn't be in that valley position. He could have definitely gone under. Anyway, I can still remember it at CJOR. This is 1966. In those days, they still exist, Young Presidents Organization throughout the world. You have to be running a company and making at least $1 million to qualify to be a member. And that's how really Jimmy started out. He was a member. He was in charge. He came to Vancouver to turn around and put on a dog and pony show with all of the members of the Pacific Northwest chapter for 3 days. And we're sitting in CJOR control room. Saturday night, I had photographed everything. Saturday night, we were at the Capilano Golf Course and the dinner dance, and the wives are there, of course. So at 3 in the morning, I arranged with the film outfit on Robinson Street to develop my pictures. Keep in mind, this is 1966. There was no Polaroid, no instant, no digital cameras or nothing. They developed the film. I took the slides. I'm sitting in the station. I did all the announcing, all of the soundtrack for all of the film presentations for at least 15 years that I was with them, until I got the first heart attack in 1980. We went from 2 projectors to 18 projectors he uses when he has people come to his corporate office. Anyway, it's now 5 in the morning. I've got the slides. I've written the story, did the audio, and now we took these 2 trays and we're putting the slides in. Jimmy says, I'll help you. He said, this is 5 in the morning. I says, Jimmy, don't. I says, you've never done this before. They've got to be in proper sequence, otherwise.
And right side up.
Yeah, right. So anyway, he helped a bit. And then he says, I'm leaving, because Sunday morning was the big final presentation. They had Dr. Robert Katz from Stanford University there to give the wrap-up message. And we went ahead. He left. I finished everything. I went home, never got any sleep. I had to set up everything in the Bay Shore around about 9 o'clock. And we were supposed to be on like at the intermission. Then Dr. Robert Katz would do his final presentation to peak off the 3-day conference. So anyway, he must have had a little bit of knowledge. He decided and said, look, we'll leave Jimmy's presentation until the end. So he did his, he didn't want to be upstaged, I think. So he did his deal. He finished and we did our flashback. Now here, the people, I'll just jump ahead. We get into the program and all of a sudden, the slides are fine for about maybe the first 10 or 15, then it went out of sync. And I had a judgment call to make. Do I either stop this thing or what? Realizing that this could make Patterson look bad and I'd be fired probably instantly. So anyway, this is a gutsy move, Mike. I asked for the house lights to go on. I stopped the equipment and I quickly realized what had happened. The slides he had put in were out of sync. So I quickly tried to juggle them into place. And while I was doing it, I said, you know, ladies and gentlemen, you realize, of course, I took these pictures. You're dancing a few hours ago, and here you're going to be able to see yourself on the screen. I said, I made the unfortunate mistake. I think we recorded at 5 in the morning, and Jimmy wanted to help me. And I said, no, but he says, come on. So these slides are a little out of sync because of his contribution. So anyway, I turned around, resumed the film, and everything went perfectly. He got a standing ovation from all the men and women there.
So you didn't get fired.
I never got fired, and it's like a horse race. It's not how you start, it's how you finish. So anyway, that really elevated him in the eyes of all these big VIPs, top entrepreneurial types. And from there, several of the people that actually witnessed that film presentation became directors of his company later on. And so the radio, in the sense of my radio days actually played a big part in helping me help him by doing all of the audiovisual filming. And Jimmy was smart. He'd always have me photograph everybody. And people used to tease me if I didn't have a camera in my hand. Oh, you can't be Will Ferrell. He used it effectively. Everywhere we went, every VIP flying all over the world, North America. We never ever left North America in the Learjet because it couldn't, it didn't have the length.
The range, yeah.
The range.
Days.
So anyway, then he'd send them the pictures at Christmas time, but the pictures were a vital start in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Your radio show is still on your website, wilfray.com,
right.
That means you're really still in the business, because so much of radio has moved to the internet these days. Most of the original creative radio is now on the internet, various stations that people are doing from all over the world, and you're just, as they say, a click away on the internet to listen to Will Ferrell.
The nice thing, Mike, I have 43 years Sunday evening for 2 hours, whereas now I'm 24/7. People can hear me 24/7, and I change my rebroadcasts every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And these are shows I recorded, as I say, when I would go in Sunday evening. And it's nice to be able to reminisce from that standpoint, but it's kept me with meaning in my life. Many times on my program, I had these what we call thoughts for successful living, like, you know, a winner never quits and a quitter never wins. My favorite one of them is, a smile is a curve that can set a lot of things straight. And I use that format along with 90% music. As I say, when I started out, I was reading scripture and all that. It was pretty heavy. But unless you really listen to the program and hear the words, it could be just any other musical show. And I've pretty well kept it that way. But I got an inspiration after coming back off of the bridge session with that rock gospel music to play some bridge music in between, and I use the standards, you know, like Stardust, Moon Glow, Moon River, Blue Moon, all of the Dancing in the Dark. I'd have Artie Shaw, Harry James, the nice smooth stuff, the strings, Henry Mancini, all of that. And I had a lot of people that I know that would never darken the door of a church, but used to listen to me on a Sunday night.
Your website also includes a lot of great pictures, historical pictures, stories about all of your careers. And I think at this time, let's switch to some of the great promotions that you did. You had some fantastic promotions, well, both for radio and for your real estate business.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. You should bring that up. When I was on the air on CKMO, and this is 1948-47 era, Jack was over at NW, and as I say, Vic was at CJOR, and I was at CKMO, which ultimately became CFUN, 1410 in the 50s. I did a promotion where I took my 46 Chevrolet. It's these big 16-inch discs that Canadian Radio had.
I've seen that picture, yes.
Yeah, and I put on a little disc jockey face. And I had this, he was called Disky, sitting up on the top of my 46 Chevrolet on the roof of the car. And I'd offer, we had Purdy's Chocolates downstairs in the Spratshaw building at Robson, Howe and Robson. And anybody that could spot Disky, the first person to call in would get a box of chocolates from me. And I'd park it maybe between the Capitol and the Orpheum on Granville, in front of the Vogue down below. But and so that was probably one of my first promotions I did. And Jack, as a matter of fact, Jimmy was going to UBC at the time and would be listening Sunday night, and he tried to find Disky on the odd occasion. So he was aware of me, and I remember the reason he, in 1950, well, I left the radio in 1950, went into 50 to 1957. I had turned around and gone into real estate as a salesman. You had to work for 2 years before you could become an agent. Then I opened up my own real estate office at Broadway and Canby, the northeast corner. And in 1957, there was a little dip in the market, and Jimmy knew that I was had this promotional. I was probably one of the first people to take a marquee and put on Thoughts for Successful Living right on the radio. It was called a radiograph, and I'd PR people. I plugged the Red Cross or Canadian Cancer Society putting on a dance. So I used it from that standpoint to have people, and on several occasions in the early days, there was just about an accident in Canby and Broadway because people were still reading what the wordage is as they drove by. But promotion-wise...
You had a house on the top of your car.
Yeah. That's the house on the top. Yeah, that's right. That was the house was a night... Oh, that's in the real estate business. Mm. Yeah, well, I started that in When we opened up our own company in 1954, Broadway and Canby, not only did I have the house on it won the best model house display at the CNE in Toronto in 1926.
Wow.
I had it light up inside. Then eventually, you remember those ticker tape little units, and you go to a bank and you see a message moving around? Well, I got one of those and had them on each side. I'd have to charge the battery every night, but I went out of my way to park the car. And you could actually, from the radio days, and I don't say this, but you could stop 10 people on Granville Street at any time and say, "Do you know the name Wilf Ray?" And 7 out of 10 answered, "Yeah," because it was my radio programming from 47 until 49, until I made the mistake going over to NW. And then, so my radio days ended in 1950, and then I came back in 1965. Although I did broadcasting, here's a picture, right? I've got all these on my wall of Monty. Remember Monty McFarlane?
Yes, I do.
Here's a picture of Monty and I when I was the advertising manager of Bull McLean from 1957. Jimmy talked me into go to work for him because the real estate business had a slump then. So I was the advertising manager in 61. And then that's when I went to work for General Motors. Well, Monty, of course, a great, wonderful air personality, really a super guy. And speaking about radio, have you heard of the RPM? Like, we get together, Red Robinson.
Yep.
You're a member. Well, I'm sure and hopefully in any of these interviews, you allude to the fact we just, you know, I met you at the last RPM, and there was about 70 or over 70 mm-hmm. guys there, you know, reminiscing. And the two oldest, of course, are Dal Richards and myself. And Dal's been in Canadian radio a long, long time. And I used to have my daughters have their 21st birthday at the Panorama Roof. Mm-hmm. I'm out here in Mission, British Columbia, and Dal will be here on Sunday, 2 days from now, doing a remembrance of the Second World War, one of the, like, D-Day and that, playing the music in the 40s, 50s,
music.
And 60s, you know. Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree, the White Cliffs of Dover, you know. To music today, to me, maybe the young people can retain it as well, but I don't think it has got the same strength to it, both in lyrics.
I don't think it'll last.
No, no. Whereas the music of our, well, of the 40s and 50s especially, has so much appeal, and even to the young people today.
There were a couple of other great promotions. One of them involved the world's largest chess game, or checkers game, I believe.
That was in 1950. I had already talked about the fact we set a North American record of 1,036 cars. What happened? We were at Bull McLean. We had a section of the lot. It was in checker format, like a game of checkers. And we called it Cadillac Square. So I decided that year on a promotion. We did it in 58 and we did it in 59. You see on my website, wilfray.com, I think is the 58 picture. That's when we had George Vandenberg and Sid Tallis, who were two baseball guys, up on a big backhoe crane, up in the air, looking down at the checkers square. There was the 64 squares. And for my pawns or checkers, I used these beautiful bathing girls. And when the player got the checker over to the other side, then the girls were crowned with, had crowns put on their head. So we stopped at traffic. There was over 5,000 people on Broadway. We actually stopped traffic there. And we did it in 1959. And that year I had Herb Capozzi. Oh, and that was said to, and who was the other? By Bailey. Up on the, no, it was By Bailey and, no, Herb, it wasn't, Herb owned the BC Lions. But I had the BC Lions and somebody from, if I had the picture in front of you, I could tell you who it was. But anyway, That's the year we set a North American record of 1,036 cars. Mm. And yeah, I guess, I mean, if there were a Guinness World Book of Records, which Jimmy owns now, and they had a section for the world's largest checker game.
That would be it.
Yeah, right. And just like in 1959, we built the BOMAC sign. At that time, it was the world's largest freestanding neon sign.
I remember that very well.
Even surpassing the stuff in Vegas that you see today.
The other great promotion, probably the best promotion that you pulled off, was your wedding. This was 57 years ago?
Well, it was 1954, Mike. This year will be our 56th wedding anniversary.
Okay.
I didn't pull it off. My wife was the one. To give you a little bit of background, we'd been going around together for 5 years, and she was getting a little anxious.
When are you going to pop the question?
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I, New Year's Eve in 1954, I presented with a ring, and we were to be engaged. And during the evening, she said, well, when are we going to get married? And I was noncommittal, so she gave me the ring back. And in February, she went to the Mardi Gras in New Orleans and said, either we're getting married or I'm moving on, you know. So she left me for 2 weeks. You know, the old slogan, absence makes the heart grow fonder. So I, when she came back, you know, gave her the ring again and she accepted. And I said, well, yeah, I'm ready to, you know, tie the knot. So May and nothing had happened. June, the Miller's Jewelers came up with a promotion. They were looking for a couple to get married to the P&E. And this is 1954. And so unbeknown to me, Marion didn't wait to be chosen. She went down to Miller's Jewelers' place and said, you know, I'm made an application. Anyway, she talked Miller's people into us. And I met them when we were invited down to their home and found out then. And so it was all set for September the 2nd. And she was smart enough to quit vacillating, and there was a date set.
That generated a lot of publicity, both positive and negative at the time, in the press.
Well, the what happened, I was naive at the time. We were at our own real estate office at Broadway and Canby. The New Westminster Ministerial Association thought it was sacrilegious. This is terrible. Denigrating marriages to be married to the P&E. So got this. They spent a week. The newspapers, the News Herald, the Vancouver Sun, and the Province, who's going to get married? And it was front page news. And so for a week, they tried to figure out who's going to get married. So after the week, one reporter comes walking in and says, are you the couple that maybe, you know, getting married at the P&E? And if you are, we'll say nothing. And so I naively said, well, that's fine. Yeah, we are. So in those days, it was a morning sun, afternoon, and an evening. It was in the evening that night, right on the front page. So when they found out that, you know, we're the ones that were going to be married there, and with all the heat from the New Westminster Ministerial Association and all the religious groups, we couldn't get anybody to marry us. So I go back to my radio days now. I remember in 1945 putting on these 16-inch discs for a beautiful, wonderful pastor by the name of Reverend W. Arnold Bennett. He was formerly the pastor of Mount Pleasant Baptist Church, but at that time he was not involved in any church of his own. So I used to put these
transcriptions.
Transcriptions on by him. Anyway, I remembered him, and he kindly consented to marry us. And so we actually got married on the lawn of our house, had a 60-car police escort out to the P&E, and my wife put on $2 million worth of Russian crown jewels. The Brinks guards were there, and we were in the Brinks guard car driven about 2.5 miles around to where the Coliseum is today. In those days, in 54, was just an outdoor theater. So I ended up giving my wedding speech in front of 10,000 people. And I've got pictures here to prove it. And we ended up having our reception down at the Cave Supper Club. And to end up this, and even to this day, I still can't figure it out. In the promotion, the bridesmaids got their gowns from Germaine's, Marion got her wedding gown, but I guess the Coupe de Resistance was the two honeymoon tickets to Mexico City.
Wow.
With, from Canadian Pacific at the time. Well, we had such a Hollywoodish type of atmosphere wedding that the next day, Sunday morning, the best man shows up at our house. We were living in 61st and Ash off of Canby Street, and we gave the two honeymoon tickets to him. And even until this day, Mike, my dear wife has never been on a honeymoon. But the sweetheart says to anybody that asks, "Oh, every day is a honeymoon."
Wow.
Isn't that nice?
And after 56?
56 years. This September the 2nd will be number 56.
Well, I'll say in advance congratulations on that, because that is some sort of a record as well, like your very illustrious career. A couple of more questions just before we finish here.
Anybody that really knows me knows I've been very promotional-minded, but I don't deserve the credit for all the notoriety on the P&E. My wife is the one that made that connection.
Throughout your long career, you've met many, many, many people. Who were some of your very favorites?
I can think of a few names. There's probably a lot more that I can't think of at this time. But in the 40s, when I was on the DX Prowl, I interviewed Stan Kenton, Peggy Lee, even Rudy Vallee. And there's a picture of me where Sammy Davis Jr. is tapping my nose. It's on Chuck Davis's Vancouver website for 1947. He was at the Commodore and with his uncle and his dad and the Will Mastin Trio. And I interviewed Sammy. He was doing voice characterizations even then. The Billy Graham, Oral Roberts in the gospel field. This is a fellow countryman because of my Lebanese background. Paul Anka, I introduced Paul to my uncle backstage when he was singing at the Cave. Oh yeah, there was a lot of personalities. I wasn't like Jack Cullen, who went out of his way to interview all the
anybody you could bring
right
in.
And so I met a lot of people, but except in when I was doing in the 40s, where I went out of my way to talk to people that way that were well known. But you know, I had a heart for a lot of great people. Keep in mind, you know, I'm 83 years young.
You've met a lot of people and worked with a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. One final question. This is probably going to be the hardest one for you to answer. Favorite moment in your 82 years involving either radio or real estate?
Mike, I think on reflection, I always had grandsons, but never any granddaughters. I think I'm up to about 6 grandsons, never had any granddaughters. And my daughter Robin, she wasn't a youngster when she did give birth. And I was actually in the delivery room when it happened to see a beautiful 7-pound girl being born. And my granddaughter in that moment to me was a real treasure. After years of hoping that we might have a granddaughter, it actually happened.
Wilf Ray, thank you very much.